TheYeshiva.net.
Okay, the following podcast, I got the honor of sitting down with Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, and we talked about amazing amount of topics. We talked to some of it. My favorite was marriage. We talked about the Aguna crisis. We talked about spirituality, the mental health field in general. So many things we talked about. He is a wealth of wisdom, and just such an amazing, amazing person. It was an amazing podcast. Just a little explanation. This is in honor of Purim. This sweatshirt that I'm wearing. We'll be having a huge sober Purim party, so I am just advertising it on my sweatshirt. That's the explanation for the sweatshirt. Please like and subscribe if you're on YouTube, and I hope you enjoy as much as I do.
Hello and welcome to the Brainstorm Podcast. And now, your host, Sonny Perlman.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for coming. And I'm going to dive right in. We'll do the intro later. So you don't have to listen to all the amazing accolades about yourself. But I am very, very excited. And I will tell you, it's been a while since I've been trying to coordinate getting you here. And I was on the way to Brooklyn and I was listening to your podcast with Mayor Kay. Collinson, right?
Yes.
And I've had him on my podcast also. I think I was listening to it because I was about to have him on my podcast. So I picked a podcast. And in the podcast, you told a story that you went to Adin Steinsaltz and to ask him some questions in life. I don't know if you remember. I can remind you. You could tell the story if you want. And I was driving in the car and just bawling. It wasn't even so emotional. But something about what you were saying was touching me so strong, even like the timeline about it. Should I remind you of the story?
Please.
Okay. So the story was you went to him and you asked him for advice. First of all, the advice is hilarious because he said after 25 years, you're going to look at yourself and you're going to see a dead mouthpiece. I don't know if that was exactly
how you
said it, right?
That I remember.
And you're just gonna realize that you're a shadow of your. It was either a shadow of yourself. I'm trying to remember this. This is like 2 years ago. Maybe I listened to this, but it was you're gonna be a shadow or a mirror image of this self that you built, but it's not gonna be you. It'll just be a guy who could just spit out great Torahs and, like, you know, make a great lecture on a whim. And even the example he gave really touched me because the example was that you get to a place where you'll be able to make a lecture. You won't even need to know what the lecture is about. You just walk up and you just see the name. This once happened to me. I always go, someone canceled the lecture and they said, "Can you take over his lecture?" And I walked up there and they're like, and then I looked at the playbook, like, what is this lecture about? And then I gave the lecture and I thought of this story. So first of all, I was amazed because I felt it was very vulnerable on your part that you were sharing that experience. But what really touched me is that I have been doing this for a really long time. And it's a constant, constant struggle to remain true to myself and to be, not try to be what everybody else is making me and what I'm telling everybody is amazing. And what I loved about it is that everybody who gets to a place like you, the world just thinks you're perfect. They have to do that for some reason. I call it Rebbe-itis. It's like you have to make them into like some sort of God figure. And you, when you were talking about it, you were breaking that image of this invincible, you were talking about an existential struggle where you have to like fight to remain alive and you. Anyway.
Why were you bawling?
I was bawling because I felt that was my struggle. Like I was like, yes, yes. And I felt like Adin Steinsaltz, through you, to me, was telling me that the fight is all right, and it's all right to, that you feel this way, and that you're slowly dying, and you have to fight to stay alive, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not the natural course of things to just get better and better because you're making better and better lectures or opening better and better programs. So it felt to me like I had permission and somebody saw me. It was coming from a very, almost like a negative place, but to me it was such comfort, and I was crying. So anyway, I don't know what the question is in there, but that's when I called you to have you on the podcast. Like, I was like, I was like, I need to have the podcast. And so the first thing I wanted to, right off the bat, is how do you deal with this struggle of maintaining your own vulnerability, your own self, who you are, while the world is looking and going, wow, wow. And truth is, there's amazing, amazing accomplishments you've done that, like, even I want to do it. I have to hold myself back. But I'm saying, but like, how do you do it? What is your experience with this? And is this something that you think about, or was it something you just talked about 2 years ago on a podcast that knocked me off my feet, even though I was driving?
Yeah. Well, how I deal with it. I have been on the other side. I understood very well what he meant. It is so easy. It is so easy to fall in to that very tempting trap. And the trap is the accolades, the validation, the celebrity status, the compliments, the standing ovations, the invitations, the fake glory and honor. That's the trap. It's a trap because it's miserable, because none of it is authentic. It's a joke. For a broken ego, it does the job for like 5 minutes. But it's an addiction like any other addiction. It's basically a self that doesn't really exist. It's a cup that has a hole, and you're trying to fill the cup with water. And that's what all these compliments do. There's a hole inside. And we pour, or I pour, we pour, 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 pour. Oh, feels so good, feels so good. There's nothing left.
It's just leaking out.
A minute later, the next day, the next hour, I need more and more and more and more, because there's an essential brokenness. And the only substitute for that is authenticity. The only substitute for that is true identity. The only substitute for that is humility, vulnerability, authenticity, alignment. I mean, if we want to, you know, take the spiritual understanding of it, you know, the way the Jewish mystics and the great giants of Jewish spirituality articulated it is, whenever I'm investing to build my ego, I'm investing in a counterfeit reality. I'm investing in a Ponzi scheme. I could put $20 billion into your Ponzi scheme, as we all know the story, with a fellow Jew.
Right.
It's nothing. It's worthless. So I can get 1,000 comments. I can have 6 million likes. I can have 300 million followers. I don't, but I can have 300 million followers. It's nice. It's geschmack. It feels good for 7 minutes.
Right.
Maybe 7 hours. It pays the bills, which is always good.
Yeah.
But it's nothing. It actually makes one, and certainly me, more miserable, because it only proves the lack of substance, the lack of authenticity. And it's really a substitute for real love, for real connection, for real attachment. And I'm investing in a self that doesn't really exist. I'm investing in a self that has developed existence based on a coping mechanism and a way of surviving in a world without real attachment, without real connection, without real truth. And as a result of that, I constantly have to resurrect it. How do you keep a dead man alive? How? You have to resurrect him every single second. That's exactly what the ego looks like. It's fragile. It's non-existent. So every day I need to keep it alive again and again. So tomorrow I need more. The next day I need more. The next day I need more. But internally, like in the picture of Dorian Gray, there's an emptiness, a void that I think Rabbi Adin Steinzelt Evan Yisrael was addressing.
Yeah.
Due to my life and my life story, I am so well aware of it. And I have to make a choice, not every day, every hour, every minute, in which space I'm going to live. If I get up to give a speech and there's 3,000 people there, 2,000 people, or 50 people, and they're enjoying and they love it and they applaud me and they tell me some very, very nice things, I need to make a choice in which space am I going to live. Will I extricate my soul from the space of authenticity and fall into the trap of celebrity status, which is feeding something that doesn't exist with compliments that are meaningless? Or will I choose to remain human, simple, authentic, connected, attached? Will I be able to watch the voices inside of me, which are really trauma voices,
right,
that say, go into that trap. It's going to feel so good. Become a god for the next hour. Why not? Become a pharaoh. Become a demigod. Become a Cleopatra. Become a fictional figure. They believe it. You start believing it.
Right.
Right? It's the story of Haman. I mean, everyone is bowing down to him. You start believing the people. They can't all be stupid. It can't be that all these people are so stupid. They're all bowing down to Haman. He started to believe the story. That's his tragedy. And then There was one old Jew by the name of Mordechai who was not bowing down to him. And why did Haman get so upset? The whole world is bowing down to you. There's one Altayid, an old Jew with a long beard, with glasses, looking into his Gemara. And when he sees you, he looks back down and he doesn't bow down to you. What's the big deal? The answer is, of course, Mordechai triggered every fiber in Haman's being, because Haman knew he's the only one who got it right. Everyone else is living in their trauma. Everyone else is living with their coping mechanisms.
So this story,
Mordechai is actually the only one who hasn't sold his soul to the devil or to stupidity. Haman was intelligent. He saw that look and he knew he's the guy who's telling the truth. So it triggered him. Suddenly he says, I gotta kill him. I gotta kill his wife. I gotta kill his whole nation. Why? Because this old man didn't bow down to you? Of course. He's the only one saying the truth.
Wow. I wonder if anybody has ever analyzed the Purim story just in the psyche. Just as if it's a muscle to your psyche, the entire thing.
The Megillah is a muscle for the psyche.
I mean, it seems like it, but
every line is a psychological story. Every line of it.
It's a wild story. So then Steinsaltz was the Mordechai in your story. I don't mean to make you almost.
No, Adin Steinsaltz actually, I respected him tremendously.
Yeah.
I asked him advice about a lot of personal things. I traveled to Israel to speak to him. And this was a priceless piece of advice. You can't get this from a lot of people, this type of advice. And I still remember. I still remember, you know, when he had a dramatic way of describing things. You know, he had a good English, but he was an Israeli. He was an Israeli, so his English, you know, was an Israeli English. But he would just, and for some reason I was talking to him in Hebrew and he was talking to me in English. I think he probably also enjoyed talking in English. And he was describing to me, you know, he was giving me the trajectory of my career, so to speak. And he said, this is 20, 25 years ago. So I was just beginning my public speaking career.
Right.
And I was in Israel. I was addressing a national convention of Jewish women in Israel in the convention center, Binyanei Haman, Jerusalem. There were 5,000 women.
Right.
All the lights were on me, so I couldn't see anybody. And I got a standing ovation, 5,000 women, and it felt good. And I just spoke to him about the whole topic, the theme, you know, that interplay between your private life, your public life, the way people see you, who you are, what I should protect myself from. And he said, you're doing well, you're going to become better. And at some point, you're going to stop preparing, because there will be no need for it. He says, now you probably prepare and you invest time and the stories, the jokes and the messages and ideas and your research, you take it seriously. But at some point, it's like, what do you want? Marriage? Okay. You'll open the filing cabinet. Shum. You know, there's 20 lectures for marriage. You know, you'll take out the right one. Then next, 45 minutes later, an hour later, an hour and a half later, you're done. You get your applause. You get your check. Everybody's happy. They're happy. They had an entertaining evening. You're happy. You made your money, you made your stamp, whatever you like it, you're fulfilled. And then he said, after 25 years, One day, I still remember, he says, one day you'll wake up, he whispered, one day you'll wake up and you'll look in the mirror and you will see that there's nobody there. There's nobody there. It's dead. All you'll see is a mouthpiece. The mouthpiece is the only thing that will be existing. The mouthpiece will have conquered the totality of your being. And he says, and at that moment, you will know that you have died. You have succeeded to die. And he finished. That was his advice. He didn't have, this was his advice.
Well, was he right? 25 years later.
I asked him. I said, how do I avoid that death?
Okay.
And he said two things that I recall. He said, one thing is, never stop learning and challenging yourself. In other words, don't just share things that you know. Share things that you're working on. Share things that surprised you and shocked you today. Share the struggles that you're dealing with today. Share your own growth. If your life will become boring, then all you'll be communicating are things that you discovered 25 years ago. If you continue to learn and challenge yourself, continue to stimulate yourself, continue to deal with your own wounds and coping mechanisms, he said, then there will be a real person, a fresh person who's growing. The second thing he said is, surround yourself with a few individuals who couldn't care less about your public persona. And your connection to them should be completely, completely raw, vulnerable, and authentic. Giving and getting feedback of people who have that exclusive relationship. He says, you just need a few people like that in your life. But those are the people who keep you anchored in reality. That's where real relationships.
You think that's why we get a wife and kids?
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
Because I tell my wife, like, I'm doing a big lecture tonight. We're doing something big. It's like, are you going to be home for dinner?
Exactly.
What's happening?
And after dinner, the garbage has to be taken out.
Right.
It's not about dinner. It's about the garbage after.
I only want you home for dinner so you can take out the garbage.
I once heard something very powerful from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's a fascinating insight. He was discussing a Rambam, the book of Maimonides, the laws of Yom Kippur. And Maimonides goes through the whole system of what Yom Kippur looked like in the times of the Holy Temple. And it was a very intense day for the Kohen Gadol, for the high priest. 7 days before, he left home, he started to prepare. A day before, the intensity has reached its momentum. And then came, you know, the Day of Atonement, right? This was the day of cleansing and healing and fixing the relationships and eliminating and transforming mistakes and transgressions. It's considered the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. And the high priest was the man. You know, he was the hero who was carrying it all, and he basically did almost everything, besides a few things that he had some assistance for. And Maimonides goes through the whole process. I mean, he went to the mikveh 5 times during that day. He had to wash his hands and feet, you know, 10 times during the day. He changed from one set of garments to another set of garments, back and forth. He went into the Holy of Holies and ignited the incense. I mean, the offerings that were done then that were never done. It goes through the entire process.
Right.
And then he says the day finishes, and he removes the golden garments, the golden vestments that the high priest always donned, and he puts on his regular clothes, and basically the day is over. But then the Rambam adds 2 words, v'yoytze lebeisei. He leaves the temple, and he goes back home. And the Rebbe asked the question, why is that detail inserted into the laws of Yom Kippur? Is that a law? I mean, obviously, the night is over, you worked hard, probably he's going to go. Where should he go after Yom Kippur? The pizza shop? He should go play pool? Where should he go?
Right.
And what if he wanted to stay in the Beis HaMikdash? What if he wanted to visit his mom? What if he wanted to visit his sister? What if he wanted to sit in the Beis Medrash and learn for 2 hours? I mean, he's allowed to.
Right.
Like, I understand he went home. I mean, usually he went home, you know. It's night, he needs to relax, he needs to eat, he's been fasting, he's been working hard. But he puts that into the laws of Yom Kippur. And the Rebbe said something very powerful. He said, this is a law. The law is that after you come out of the Holy of Holies, and after you've reached the greatest heights, do you know how to go home? Do you know how to go home back to your wife and children? Do you know how to be a normal person and stand in the kitchen? Because very often, when this high priest comes home, what does his wife say? Oh, was this a hard day? I don't really like this job of yours. Do me a favor. You know what? This house is a mess. Can you fill up the dishwasher? And I need Yanka to be tippet ben. Vardy hasn't had a bath in 2 weeks. Go give her a bath. And he's like, Ribbono Shalom, I was in the Holy of Holies. I atone for the whole world. I heal the whole world. I should be giving baths. I should be taking out the garbage. Come on. But if he cannot do that, that means the Rebbe said his Yom Kippur was an ego trip. It was a narcissistic ego trip. In fact, the Rebbe said this is the most important law of Yom Kippur.
That's the most important one.
How do you know you were in the Holy of Holies? For real? If you can go home. If you can't go home, it means it's not integrated. There's no fusion. Heaven is also a form of escapism. Heaven is also a coping mechanism. Your coping mechanism happens to be holy and spiritual. Okay, it's better than other coping mechanisms. But it's still, you're disengaged.
Right.
You're not fully present. You're not embodying the truth. You're not embodied. So
yeah.
So that's really, you say, do we get married? I think that's a major part of a relationship. A major part of a relationship is a relationship that's not based on anything external and any projection, but it's based on your most fragile and vulnerable spaces.
Right.
That's what a relationship is. A real relationship.
It's something that I really, really loved about the Rebbe that is not talked about a lot, I think, is that nobody really knew so much about what happened in his house. He would just go to his house and be with his wife. I don't know if he had a separate life.
This is very, very true. You're touching on a very, very, I think, sensitive and true point. The Rebbe never had children.
Right.
He was married to his wife, Rebbetzin Chaya Mushka, for 59 years. She passed away before their 60th wedding anniversary. The next year would have been their 60th wedding anniversary. And it's interesting, usually a Rebbe, especially of such magnitude,
right,
the Shabbos meals could be a major part of the vibe,
yeah,
of the experience. In other Hasidic circles, they have the main tish on Friday night.
Right.
The Rebbe, both the Friday night meal, the Shabbos day meal, for 60 years, he ate only with his wife. There was not one other person there. There was not one other person there. Friday night, this Rebbe, he is two people. You know, he's the one who initiated thousands of Chabad houses, each one with guests between 20 or 300 people.
Right.
Pesach Seders from Nepal to Hawaii to Alaska to Peru to the Congo to Vietnam, where tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, millions of Jews have a Seder today in Israel and the world because of the Rebbe.
Right.
But his Seder was two people. Him and
Which
his
is
wife.
Wild.
Him and his wife. Two people at the Seder. Who does a Seder with two people? You know? After his wife passed away, his Seder consisted of one person.
So he took the Yitzel Beisai like very seriously.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I thought about it.
It was interesting. The Rebbe would come out Friday nights at 7:70. After davening, he would stay and learn a little bit. Actually, not a little bit, a few hours. And then he would walk home. The Rebbe also didn't like an entourage. So he would walk home alone late. And Friday night, Shabbos day. And it was as he went to his home, and I think also his wife provided something. This is just my speculation, I don't know. I think she provided something very sacred and special for him, because the Rebbe by nature was extremely, extremely, if I could say so, introverted.
Mm.
Truly introverted. Meaning, being a Rebbe was not part of the trajectory of his life, and it wasn't, I think, in his plans. He was a very, very private, private person, very intimate person. He once wrote to somebody in 1949, "I don't have a skill for public activism." He wrote this to Rabbi Yaakov Lando, the rabbi of Bnei Brak. He says, "You do, I don't."
Mm.
Now, for somebody who didn't have a skill for public activism, you have to say he didn't do bad for himself.
Right.
So the truth is that this entire public persona of the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very contrary to his nature. And Nietzsche was extremely reserved. He wasn't very social. He was very kind, and he could connect very deeply to people, but he wasn't the social type,
right.
Schmoozer. Completely not. Very, very private. Like, I heard from people before he became a Rebbe, like, nobody knew him. He was clandestine. And even afterwards, I could see.
Do you relate to that part of the Rebbe? I'm curious. I'm saying yourself. I relate to that. I really want to run away always. Like everything I'm doing, it makes sense. Like I feel like an introvert my whole life. And I see other people that are much more talented at being out there in the public.
Some people are very talented at it, yeah.
And I would always rather go home.
If you would have a choice to spend the night going to a chasana or a bar mitzvah or hanging out with people, where you could just lock yourself up in your bedroom, cuddle yourself up under the blanket. I mean, you know probably the choice you would have.
It's amazing. You know there's a word. You ever heard the word FOMO, fear of missing out? There's another word called JOMO, which is joy of missing out.
Nice.
And I heard it. It made my day.
I like that.
It's not. It's the almost the opposite.
I like
the
that.
Joy. Okay, I want to change topics a little bit because I do have a couple of things I want to cover. And I feel like I want to talk to you for 5 hours because you are someone I really, really respect in terms of your opinion on things. So I know I was going to leave the accolades for later, but the topic I want to talk to is a much more broad topic because I'm very deeply in the mental health world and the addiction world. And the question I'm having, and it feels like I'm almost off the path with this question, is the world keeps seeming, at least in terms of mental health, keeps seeming to get worse and worse and worse. And to the point where I just saw a statistic that 41% of children in America are diagnosed with a mental health disorder. I have so many other statistics, but I'm not going to go through all the statistics. It just seems to be getting worse and worse. And in my own experience, the phone calls do not stop, and I'm sure you're experiencing the same thing. It's constant, and it's hard. It's hard for me, and I'm glad I have a base site to go to and get my, my home fix. But it's constantly this, and what's driving me a little crazy is that we have more therapy and more therapeutic help than ever before.
More in history.
It never existed in history.
And more now, comfort than ever before in history.
More comfort.
Kids have more freedom and prosperity and luxury than they ever had in history.
So, I mean, my question is more along the like, shouldn't we be seeing a little bit of like we hit the bottom and like the therapy is starting to make a dent? This is where I am really struggling with this. I'm curious like how you see the big picture of this. Yeah. Like what exactly do you see as what is happening here?
Right.
Like why aren't we moving in the direction of healthier? Unless I'm missing something. Right. Maybe I'm missing something, but that's my experience.
Right. So it's a fascinating, fascinating question, a very painful question, and a burning and relevant question.
Yeah.
So one school of thought maintains that this was all a horrific experiment at the expense of our children. The last few decades, society went into the direction of how you're feeling. Tell me, Bubala, what's bothering you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you don't like that mommy wants you to take a shower tonight? Okay, you'll take a shower next year. I'm using a little humor, but you get the point. Where instead of the drill sergeant philosophy, education, authority, this is what Tati said, this is what mommy said, this is what makes kids happy, this is what makes teens happy, stop giving them all the responsibility, stop finding out how they feel. They don't know how they feel. Just put them on the right path, right pressure, right discipline, right penalties. And of course, it's all with love. That's what love is. Love is to make them mentioned, to make them responsible people. Now we created a generation of spoiled, narcissistic brats who are just talking about emotions, and it's hard for them to stick anything out and to deal with pressure. And everything causes anxiety, and everything became a disorder. That's what they tell you now. Everything is a disorder. You're not shy. You have a disorder. Right. You're not stressed out. You're dealing with anxiety. You're not having a hard day. You're depressed.
That's a good. You asked the question better than me.
This is a school of thought today.
It's a school of thought,
and it's blaming all the voices in society, and this includes, of course, also Orthodox society, Torah society, Jewish Orthodox society, that they say fell prey to this trap of being too sensitive to every single internal emotion, confusing children when they're young, and thus allowing them to take a path which often leads to their own moral, emotional, and spiritual decline.
Okay.
And they say, proof is in the pudding. After all your years, what do you guys have to show? We have to show 4,000 years of consistency. We have to show that repression has been successful. As a mother told me the other day, look at me. I'm a soldier. I put one... I love it. I put one foot ahead of another foot. And you think my mother was easier than me? She's much harder than me. Do I talk to my mother like my daughter speaks to me? My mother said, do I ever think... You think my mother wasn't worse than me? She was much worse than me, this mother says. But I knew you respect your mother and father. You sit at the Shabbos table till the end. You don't go to the Shabbos table because I'm not in the mood. I'm not in the mood. Mood? Who ever heard about moods? This is like a new invention. Feelings, moods, emotions, self-expression. Don't repress, don't suppress. Voices, coping. Just do what you want. And of course, what about God? Accept the yoke of God.
Right.
Follow his path. Am I making a good case for this?
Just, I so far I love
Maybe
it.
People will start hiring me.
Yeah. By the way, we're not going to cut just that clip out. There has to be that would go viral. Rabbi Wawai just changing his mind
and saying, "Look, the proof is in the pudding. Come on." Doesn't data show anything? Shouldn't, you know, what do they say? You know, you're entitled to your own opinions, not to your own facts. What are the facts?
Right.
Shouldn't truth follow facts? I get emails and correspondence from people much less often now, but exactly with this point.
The way that's expressed has an answer pumped into it, meaning I am not saying that that's the solution. I'm not even in the question. I'm not saying that's the solution. I'm just asking the question from a questions place of something's happening. I'd like to hear, you know, like a bigger version of what is happening.
Those people are answering it. Right. They have a clarity and they believe that we have turned trauma, the word trauma. You know, people always tell me, you used to teach Torah, and now you teach trauma.
Right. That's
true. And create trauma because of it.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it. And I'll tell you something. There may be some sparks of truth in the lecture I have just given with fire and brimstone. There may be sparks of truth, which means very often we blur the line between self-actualization, self-expression, self-respect, self-love, and falling prey to our most superficial instincts, demons, cravings, inclinations. And in the name of self-acceptance, we often don't understand what it means to live life to the fullest, to challenge our coping mechanisms, to stimulate our deepest and highest angels, to be able to distinguish between the parts of us that have become shells and protectors and husks, and the parts of us that we make us divine, and that compassion and empathy and self-love does not mean the legitimization and execution of every single instinct and emotion I have when it may destroy my life or the life of my loved ones. So I think there is a lot of truth, or at least there's certain kernels of truth in the fact that so many boundaries have been blurred, and we could often confuse empathy and love with a decline in moral vision and clarity. And that's something that has to be addressed. But the way I see it, it's just the way I see it, is that we're really touching a much, much deeper and larger phenomenon. It's just my feeling. It's my sense. I don't have scientific or heavenly evidence for this. And that is, I think, what we're actually seeing is the outcry for the ultimate healing and authenticity. Or to put it in Jewish terms, the new generation is asking us to live redemption, not to talk redemption, but to live redemptive consciousness. And what I mean is as follows. The Jewish people in the world has been in exile for many years. Exile, by definition, means alienation, emotional alienation. Exile is not just geographic. Exile is existential. It means my soul is misplaced.
Right.
My passion is hidden. I don't know who I am. There's a dissonance. There's a dissonance. Redemptive consciousness means there's unity. There is oneness. The presence of true infinity of the source of all reality is manifested in reality. I think that our youth are begging for this consciously and unconsciously. Show me a Judaism. Show me a life, not just a Judaism. Show me a marriage. Show me a life. Show me a home without dissonance. I want a home that is truly, truly vibrating with ultimate, ultimate truth, with ultimate authenticity, which means ultimate vulnerability. I don't want that our relationship, my relationship with my father, with my mother, with my brothers, with my sisters, with my rabbis, with my teachers, with my educators, with God, should have to be based on so much repression and suppression. I don't want that Torah should mean anything else but the ultimate celebration of life, the ultimate alignment with the source of all energy. They want that Judaism should actually feel viscerally as a system of life that allows you to plug in to the source of electricity, to the source of energy, to the source of life, instead of feeling that we have what to hide, we're covering up politics, corruption. At best, we just want you to toe the line to give us all nachas and make our community feel good. At best, I want that my family should look good and ultimately do the right thing like your parents and grandparents and great-great-great-grandparents did, which will save you from a lot of trouble and you live a good life and your kids will give you nachas. And you know what? It doesn't speak to so many of them. And the reason it doesn't speak to them is because their soul is searching for ultimate meaning, for ultimate truth. And I think it's an opportunity for all of us to deal with our stuff. It's an opportunity for all of us. It's an outcry for all of us to enter a different realm of life. And it's a tall order. But I think anything else, we will be failing ourselves and our future. There is too much. When truth starts being revealed in the world, what happens is the lies start fighting like never before. When I was a young man, this is in the early 1990s, the Rebbe used to say almost every Shabbos, and I did not understand what he was talking about. He used to say that there is an energy of redemption in the world. It's here. What's needed is for us to open our eyes, and when we open our eyes, we'll see that it's here. This was his last message. Then he fell ill and he passed away shortly after. What's the Rebbe talking? What is he talking about? I mean, yeah, every Jew hopes for Mashiach, and certainly the Rebbe hoped for Mashiach, and always spoke about Mashiach, but what is he talking about? I think, at least partially, looking back, it says it takes 30, 40 years till you understand your Rebbe, the Gemara says. It took a few decades. Right. I think he was articulating this. Once there's a certain energy of emes, of truth that comes into the world, there's no going backwards. This is it. So basically, if we don't embrace it fully, you know what we're left? We're left with nothing. The old paradigms are not working anymore. The new paradigms we're not ready to embrace. So you know what you have? You have crisis. You have a breakdown. The Alter Rebbe.
Maybe the meaning of redemptive consciousness and I'm just speculating here, is that we are finally understanding exile on a personal level.
It's a major part of it. As the Rebbe once said, the person who doesn't understand what redemption is can't understand what exile is also. So remember, the only reason we can understand what personal exile is because we have a foretaste of what redemption looks like. In the world of healing, we know that when you start feeling viscerally the pain of the dysfunction of your life, it's the beginning of redemption. On a spiritual level, it means your soul is starting to talk. Your soul is starting to tell you what could be, what the possibilities are. Your soul is telling you who you were meant to be. You weren't meant to be a slave defined by the atrocities and the abuse and the sickness of the people in your family or your community who have wreaked havoc in your psyche, and now you're blaming yourself for 30 years, for 20 years. You don't deserve to be that person. Your soul is much bigger than that abuser's sickness, who never dealt with his sickness from someone else, whatever happened to him. And suddenly, for 20 years or 10 years or 5 years or 40 or 50 years, my soul was so dormant, I didn't know about it. So I was a happy person. I was happy in my dysfunction. And right. Suddenly one day, things are disintegrating. Why? It's a good sign. Your soul is sending a message. You're in exile. You're a victim. You're in a wretched situation. Your heart is in jail. Oh, wow, yeah, I'm dysfunctional. Now I have a choice. Am I going to begin the journey of real integration, of real healing? The Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe, gives a beautiful metaphor. He says, you take a seed that's on your windowsill. It's a beautiful seed. Yeah. It's intact. It's nice. You put it in a frame, and then you take it, and you put it into the ground. You put it into the earth. It's going to decompose completely. But only from the decomposition will a tree grow. He uses beautiful words. He says, between one yesh and another yesh, there's an ayin be'emtza, which means when you go from one something that is a very miniature something and you take a quantum leap to the ultimate something, there is nothingness in between.
Right.
There's a quantum jump that requires a sense of decomposition. And I think that's our generation.
Wow. It's interesting because I had Rabbi Kalish on in the podcast, and he said something that really struck me, which was that we were talking about enabling, which is a great topic of mine. It's a big trigger word for me, enabling. So we were talking about that, and he said he thinks that we're enabling people not to see their soul by forcing them to toe the line. I mean, he's saying it a little different. That's the enabling. I mean, when we allow someone to find themselves, their brokenness, and to be able to start the healing, that's where the real work, that's where the real healing happens.
Yeah. And I always tell this to myself, I tell this to parents and educators. When you're triggered by your children, rather than aroused with compassion, it's usually much more about you than about them. This is your opportunity to heal. This is your opportunity to confront your demons. Don't dive back into your trap. Don't dive back into your wounds. Wow. Develop new neural pathways. You know, Yogi Berra.
You're ruining my next question, because my next question was, how do I get my kids to do exactly what I want so I could be happy again?
Listen, the model of control is very prevalent, and we have moral authority for it. That's part of our problem. We have a source in Torah for everything. And they're good sources. Moral authority. Respect your parents. Respect your teachers. God knows better. It's true. God knows better. But can I trust that God's light is present in each one of my children? Can I trust that when the greatest mystic said that Moshe said, Einoid Movade, means that the truth of oneness vibrates through every soul, and that the ultimate message of Yiddishkeit is not suppression but alignment? It's letting go of my coping mechanisms, letting go of my insecurity, of my guilt, of my shame, of my fear, so I can actually become a channel for infinite love and light. Is that real or not real? If it's real, I trust. If it's not real, I control. Part of redemptive consciousness is relinquishing spiritual control. Not because you don't care, because you care too much, because you trust, because you're connected, because you're ready to face your demons. And when we're not ready to face our demons, we will blame everybody and everything, especially those poor children who are simply saying, Tati, stop lying to yourself. Tati, you're a miserable man. Tati, Judaism for you is hell. Tati, you hate God subconsciously. You're just scared to say it. I'll say it for you.
Right.
Tati, you hate God.
You met my kids?
Tati, how much do you love God? Every day you say, V'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha, love God with all your heart, with all your soul. Tati, you love God with all your heart, with all your soul? Do you even know what it means to love with all your heart, with all your soul? You can't even love yourself with all your heart, with all your soul. How in the world do you love this invisible God who afflicted you with all these meshugana kids? Because you believe in divine providence, Tati, don't you? You're not an atheist like me.
Right.
You understand what's happening?
Yeah.
The father who listens to that, and he knows how much she hates. Or he knows maybe not how much he hates, but how much anger he has. He knows how much despair he has. He knows about his inner stuff with his spouse. He knows about his own cravings. He knows about his own skeletons. He doesn't talk to anybody about it. You know, he may be the gabbai in the shul. He may be running the kiddush. He may be the president of the synagogue. He may be the honoree at the dinner. He may give the shir daf yomi. I don't know. Or he may be just a good, you know, real estate broker.
Right.
I wanted to say a farmer, but I don't know too many.
I thought you were going
to
say like the person who runs our village. Let's get nervous.
I once saw something that's incredible. I always say it before Pesach. I say, you know what's this custom we have, right? Yachatz, we split the matzah, and then we have the afikoman, and we put away the afikoman, and then we're going to retrieve it later at the Seder. And the old Jewish custom is our children take the afikoman, and basically they steal it, or right. At least they take it. You know, we hit it, our children our children find it, and then they're the ones who have to give it back to us, and they want a prize. What's this whole custom? I said, every one of us in life has things that we hide. That's the fact. And the Seder is teaching us, whatever you hide, your children are going to bring to the fore. We all have those afikaimans. It's called safun. Safun means hidden secrets, consciously or unconsciously. I may be a very good guy. This is not malicious. This is not judgment. This is all unconscious. I may be doing this since I'm 4 years old. It's my own coping mechanism. These things are just hidden beneath the surface. You know what? Who's gonna bring it to the fore? Your son. Your daughter.
Yeah.
You say, Mommy, Tati, here's the Afikoman, Bubby, Zaidi, here it is. And I could look at my child and say, how dare you? How dare you? You spoiled generation listening to too many Rabbi YY clips and enabling all this self-centered Judaism. Healing, 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 healing. I just saw a clip. You may have seen it. Leah Rabashkin was interviewed by Ellie Nash. Oh, right.
I didn't see the whole thing.
She speaks about her abuse as a child. You know, it's a harrowing story, but it's the triumph of her spiritual growth. And she mentioned that somebody in her family called her selfish for exploring emotions.
Right.
Yeah. A distant relative. I don't mean in the... Called her selfish for exploring emotions. You understand? We allow these kids to be raped at the age of 3.
Right.
I don't mean that anybody maliciously allowed in the family. I mean... We were not sensitive to the plight of these kids.
Right.
Besides that, we bequeath to them our issues, and then we blame them for not repressing what we managed to repress for 30 years. And then we get upset at them. We call them selfish because they want to be authentic, because they want to be able to say, I love God with all my heart, with all my soul, because they're ready to confront every part of their animal soul and transform it. Because they're ready for the work of transformation rather than suppression. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
How are you capable of transforming your negativity if you don't expose it? Is there anything in life that you can transform without holding it up in front of you? I never saw such a thing. How can I let go of something? We say, let go, let go, let go, stop it. How can you let go of, a therapist once told this to me, he said, how can you let go of something if you're not ready to hold on to it? By definition, you can only let go of hatred, of fear, of guilt, of shame, of insecurity, of isolation, of detachment, if you're ready to hold on to it. Right. Holding on to it is painful. Oh, I have to acknowledge it. I have to feel it. So I look at my children with those afikaimans. They're all holding afikaimans. They say, here it is. And it's always a broken matzah. It's always a broken matzah. It's never a whole matzah.
Right.
It's a broken matzah. And I say, how dare you? Or I look at my child and I humbly take the afikaiman. I give him a prize. And I say, thank you. Now I could finish my Seder and say, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. Now we can march towards redemption. We can only march towards redemption when we relinquish all psychological control for real. And it's a very hard thing to do. If you don't acknowledge how hard it is, you're not doing the work.
Wow. I don't want to make another Dvar Torah on it, but I'm thinking it's called a Seder. And I think that wonderful message of that your kids have to make you authentic before you could tell them the story.
always.
You don't get to tell the story until you look at yourself, and then you get to see the story. You see it. You see it as you're all four of the children or whatever. Okay.
So you know what? Those who are engaged in this work of vulnerability know exactly what it looks like. They know what it means to let go of control. They know what it means to really, really trust the soul. They know what exclusivity and intimacy look like. They know what it means to experience the magic of attachment without the need to judge, to control, to manipulate, to exploit, but to be fully present. And if we believe that Einoid Mulvade, that we are all derivatives of infinite consciousness, we are all infinite consciousness having a finite experience. If we really believe that, we may not. But those of us who preach this, you know, you're a chelek elekam mimal, and Hashem is everything. What in the world do these words mean? I grew up in a Chabad home, a very, very Hasidic. I grew up in a very Hasidic community.
Right.
I learned the spiritual texts of Hasidus and Kabbalah much of my life. I took to it. I taught it. I preached it. I still preach it. I pontificate it. But I do have to say something, and that is few were the people when I was growing up until today who knew how to present this information viscerally. It was all intellectual stuff. It was detached from many of us.
Right.
Not that people were people that were insincere, but even sincere people, sincere. They wanted to do the right thing. They were doing the right thing. But we didn't have the tools to translate. We didn't have the language to communicate the message of the mind to the body. Or in the language of Tanya, the divine soul didn't know how to speak to the animal soul.
Right.
So a lot of the information, we say it, Hashem, 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 God, Torah, mitzvahs. How real is it? How real is it?
Right. Well, okay, so let me just do a tiny bit of pushing back, because yes, I hear it. I hear we're in this time of brokenness, a time of, like, you know, a rock bottom of our nation and of our people and of the world. Like, something is cracking that has to be fixed, and we're in that direction. What I'm finding, and especially because this is the work I do here with community and building community, is that everybody is so separated from each other. It's like two things happening at once. We have the ability to think and feel and whatever we want. We have all the time in the world to feel all these feelings. At the same time, we're so separated from each other. So if I try to explore these incredibly difficult existential crises that we're going through, or our trauma or whatever we want to deal with, I have no container that holds me in, because we're also separated. Meaning, like, wouldn't, you know, like, I'm like trying to figure out, because you go to therapy, I have this line that, like, therapy is only for healthy people. It's a funny line. But, like, if you go to therapy, you take a homeless guy, you stick him into therapy, he has the best therapist in the world, charged $900 an hour, and then he goes back to the street, he's not getting better. He needs a container of healing to be able to hold him. And we are so fragmented.
And we need support systems. Every person, right? It takes a village to raise a child.
Right.
It takes a village to heal all of us. We all need support systems. And that's why the most blessed work we can be doing here is preventive medicine. When we allow young people to enter into marriages that are based on humility and authenticity and self-awareness and other awareness and the journey of growing together, and they raise generations with that spirit, we create support systems. Every person needs a support system.
Right.
Without it, I can have the most acclaimed therapist in all of history, and I can go from one therapist to another therapist, from yoga to Pilates to the gym to another type of therapist to a somatic
therapist.
Unless
it's psychedelics. Oh, okay.
And when it comes to psychedelics, integration
right.
is indispensable. People who take serious healing plans or whatever it is, you know, which creates awareness, without integration, it can be very, very disastrous.
Right.
You open yourself up to your unconscious. Is there anybody to massage the wounds? Is there anybody to caress the wounds? Is there anybody to say, what am I supposed to do in a week from now when I'm back in the same toxic environment? Like, the work, it's all the Yotze Lebesoi. Can the high priest go back home? Trust me, in the Holy of Holies, he experienced the consciousness of infinity.
Right.
All the layers were removed. That's why so many high priests died. The Gemara says the Talmud said in the time of the Holy Temple, most of the high priests on Yom Kippur, they died in the Holy of Holies.
They couldn't handle it.
Once your soul experiences a certain voltage of electricity, if your body can't contain it, if you're not in the state of consciousness that is fertile for this, you're finished.
Right.
You're not coming
back. I feel that way about therapy, all these processes, all of them.
So who's going to allow the high priest to come home? He needs a home base. He can't stay in Kodesh HaKadoshim and the Holy of Holies for the rest of his life. It's not what God wants. The soul came down. We could have all stayed in heaven. Over there, we wouldn't have these conversations. No trauma in heaven. No coping mechanisms in heaven. No lies in heaven. But there's also no transformation in heaven. In heaven, we don't have the miracle of relationships, the miracle of transforming darkness into light. And that's why the support system triumphs over everything. That's why marriages today need to be healed. How many marriages? Marriage is a good metaphor for all this. Not a metaphor, an illustration. Yeah. How many marriages, you know, we have in our culture, divorce is considered something negative, a tragedy, okay?
Right.
You know about this topic personally. And that notion is a blessing because we cherish marriage and we cherish strong, united families. But let's understand something. How many marriages are dysfunctional on the inside, even though they continue on the outside? Right.
I will tell you that I'm feeling. My wife says to me, "Hold on 1 second. I just want to see something.
Sorry.
Okay. They're both working, Ellie. So my wife says to me, like, that I'm like too far into the gutter to be able to really see the world. You know what I mean? It was like I'm.
Your
sometimes
wife has a point.
She has a point.
My wife told me once. She said, "You are getting too many." Dark emails.
It's too many.
To be able to have a clear view of all the positive stuff.
Right. Well, because I literally look around. I'm using literally in the literal sense. Not because I'm young. I'm not. So I look around and I almost never see a marriage that I'm like, these guys are really, they have connected. I'm not knocking any of my friends' marriages or anything like that, but it's become like a rare gem. If I even to the point where I'm embarrassed to share if I have good marriage stories, like, oh my gosh, what my wife did for me, it's like, and then I got to be worried who in the room is going to be like, oh, him and his, like, I'm.
Mr.
That's
Romance,
where I'm at.
Mr. Romance.
Yeah, you know, they make fun of me. Everybody makes fun of me about all that stuff. Yeah. But
you understand, they make fun of you. It's a cry of desperation.
No, I understand that.
A cry of desperation.
But what is happening?
And when I can't have it, I mock others. That's my only defense system. I mock others. Oh, romance. Oh, go run home to your wife. Little baby needs his wife. We stay here in Shul. We get drunk at the Kiddush, and we mock our wives.
Right.
In the name of, you know, progressive sophistication, it's really the desperate cry of people dying inside. When a marriage is not really, really wholesome, there's so much suffering, there's so much agony, because we were designed to be attached. Attachment is not luxury. Attachment is the very fabric of the DNA of life. In the animal kingdom, in the botanic world, never mind in the human race. The first thing the Torah says that's not good. Everything was good. Hashem created the world. God saw it was good. It was good. It was good. It was good. Friday, it's perfect. Not perfect. Toiv Moed, it's very good. And we're waiting. So what's not good? What's not good? The first thing he says, Loi Toiv. You know what's not good? Hayoisa Adam Lavadai.
Right.
Not good. That's the first not good in the Torah.
Not good
idolatry.
To be alone.
Not idolatry. Not promiscuity. Not sin. Before all that, it's not good for Adam to be Lavado, to be alone. Why? It's not an intellectual, philosophical, detached idea. It's the visceral experience of every living organism, especially a living soul. We cannot be levada. And when we are, we create substitutes.
Yeah.
If I didn't get real love, I'm going to need to substitute it by getting validation.
Which brings us back to like the big speeches.
First topic. So yeah. My entire career, that's what Rabbi Adin was really telling me. My entire career for 90 years may be to fill a void of a four-year-old who never experienced real attachment. And therefore he needs that 9,000 people in an auditorium should say, you're worth something. You're good. I love you. You changed my life. Wow, I wish you could move to my community and inspire me. And the poor 50-year-old man is really a 3-year-old. Wow, oh, I exist. I have worth. I have value. I have value. Attachment is the intrinsic divine need for connection, and there's a reason for it. It's not just evolutionary biology, because as hunters and foragers, when we hunted in groups, there was more of a chance that we're going to get the tiger rather than the tiger getting us.
Right.
That's not the key issue. There's something much deeper. If the truth is that the whole world comes from oneness, so we're one, attachment just means we are who we really are. We're all connected to oneness, so we're all one. We are derivative of oneness. If we are all manifestations of infinity, we are one. So attachment simply means I'm aligned with who I am. Lack of attachment means I'm an isolated creature, which means I'm disconnected from my own reality. That's painful. So I need substitutes for that.
And we're out of alignment.
We're out of alignment. So now I need attachment. So what's the attachment going to be? Maybe my phone. Maybe prostitution.
But we have wives. We have husbands. What? Why are we not grabbing this? What? I need to understand it better because I sometimes watch couples and I'm like, the answer to all your problems is right here in this room, right next to you. It's not all the answer, but it's the connection between you two. You could change
everything.
The universe. That's what it feels like to me. But we will do everything to fight against it. What is that fight that people are like? I literally feel embarrassed to share stuff, and it's something I realize. Like even on my podcast, like I'll talk about all these other topics, but my favorite topic is my wife. Like I really like my wife. That's the truth.
It happens to be
I even love
that
her.
With you and some of your siblings that I've met over the years, I saw a common denominator that many of them have very good marriages.
It's weird. Because we know how bad it is. No, it's something where
is it that you guys received or learned? I see a few of your siblings who I know.
It's true.
And I see good marriages.
And they see good, right. Well, I do have a theory on this. I do. My theory is my mother taught us how to be married. And not in the sense of being married. She was not married. She was divorced.
How old were you when she?
She's like 7 years old. So she... But she had a way of looking at life that was very, very big picture. Like, we have no money, but somehow we're all going to the Simcha together in Eretz Yisrael. Doesn't make any sense. For the family, which was a little cult-like, everything is taken care of. Like, the whole essence of our existence was the family and the house and what was happening in it. Whatever it is, with the dysfunction or not dysfunction, what happened there was, I think the message was, when you find the right thing, that's it. You fight every tooth and nail to make that work. And we all kind of said, marriage is it. Having kids, having a family, that's it. They're also great parents, my siblings, which is pretty awesome to watch. Like, it's not like it's easy. Everybody's going through their own struggles, but I think that there's a big picture of the answer is this, and you put everything in. So I don't know if it doesn't come from us looking at good marriages. I didn't see a good marriage until I was like, I think around bar mitzvah time. My sister got married, and I really loved their marriage.
One word that comes to mind is safety. For a marriage to have this type of closeness and trust, I think the husband and wife both have to feel real, real safety. I don't mean, of course, only physical safety, obviously.
Right.
You know, if the husband is screaming and throwing dishes, if the woman, obviously, there's not going to be safety. But I'm talking about a much deeper type of safety. And that is the safety that I could truly be me and you can truly be you. So that we can go back to those wounds that have forced us to develop all of our coping mechanisms and undo them. Undo our coping mechanisms. The only real connection that happens between people is when our souls are open. Because that means my heart is open. It means my love is open. It means my insecurities are gone. It means my fears are not controlling my life. It means I can truly, truly experience the true me, so I can really experience the true you. But how many of us have access to that part of ourselves? I can't love you if I can't love me. And I don't just mean love me, you know, take care of myself and make sure that I get enough sleep. That too.
Treat yourself.
That you have to respect yourself. Yeah. I'm talking about love me is love the me that is the raw, vulnerable child pre my coping mechanisms. I don't even know who that is. How am I even supposed to know? I may believe that that little child is such a grotesque, ugly, sick, undesirable baby that he forever has to remain hidden in a closet. Because if anybody knew who Rabbi YY really, really, really was, I'm not being invited to any podcasts. So you're going to pay my bills. Who's paying my bills?
That's the only reason I invited you. I have a feeling I know. No, I'm kidding.
Right? And these are decisions we make at 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Do we even know about these decisions? These are pre-verbal decisions, especially if you had to confront abuse, sexual, emotional, physical, psychological, spiritual, especially. Coping mechanisms are even if you grew up in a fine family, because the world is imperfect. But if you really had to deal with stuff, now I come into a marriage, right? I come into a marriage. Maybe I coped with my abuse or with my trauma by disassociating. I don't feel. In yeshiva, I'm the top boy. It's a hazard to feel in yeshiva. Right. If I don't feel, right, I'm learning Gemara 12 hours a day. Rosh Hashiva gives a shir. I can refute him from a Tosfos, from a Rambam. I'm the hero of the century. I'm the next Rabbi Akiva Eiger.
Right.
Nobody told me that's not going to work in marriage. If I refute my wife, so now I get married, and I think, you know, how am I going to become popular? I'll refute my wife just like I did the Rosh Hashiva. And I'll tell my wife, you know, Tosfos is against you. The Rambam is against you. God is against you. And somehow my wife is not impressed. She's like, you know.
Right.
So she starts poking at my emotions. But those emotions have been locked up in jail for 18 years. I don't know, 25 years. So she is now my worst enemy. Not because I'm a bad guy, but because she is threatening to open up a can of worms that I had to lock up 20 years ago to survive. Because if I would have felt, I would have had a dagger in my chest every day and I would have been a dead man, a dead child. So I disassociated in order to connect, in order to live. In yeshiva, it's great. In shul, it's great. In business, it's great. But the one relationship that needs authenticity and raw emotion becomes the greatest threat for me. So who becomes enemy number one? My wife. And the more she loves me, the more dangerous she is. But nobody knows this. Everyone is acting in good faith. The husband is trying to be a good Ben Taira and a good Yid. And he's learning Mesillas Yesharim and all these svarim about good midos. And he's controlling his anger. And he's going to therapy because he wants to help himself. And he's learning about, you know, understanding his emotions and then controlling them and seeing where it's coming from. Does he know that pre-verbally he has shut down himself? He doesn't even know who he is. He has no body awareness. He has no emotional awareness. And the poor wife is blaming herself because she's a good Jewish girl and you blame yourself. If she'll be more this and she'll be more this and she'll be more this and she'll be more this. And what about all those who then go to pornography and go to addiction? And the wife says, if I would dress up nice and I would be more beautiful, I'd be more frum and I say more tehillah. And there's a complete lack of awareness of anything really going on. So you have two people. Yeah. Triggering each other 24/7 without an ounce of safety. And they both mean well. And none of them know what they're doing. And they're good people. And their marriages are falling apart. And they're trying their best. They don't want to get divorced because they actually like each other. They're good people. They're nice people. They really, actually, God brought them together, but they don't know it. Because his trauma is triggering her trauma. Her trauma is triggering his trauma. So they're both now in active trauma 24/7 unconsciously, which means it's stronger than ever. You know, conscious trauma I can deal with. Unconscious trauma defines me in my totality 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
And now you come to them and say, come on, guys, get your marriage together. You guys are a powerhouse. They don't even hear what you're saying. All they hear is a third enemy just came into the room to destroy our lives. This Meshuggah therapist, how do we get rid of him?
That's true.
How do we get rid of this crazy guy?
Well, sometimes it helps because they want to get rid of you. It's like a common enemy. Bring them together.
What has to happen? What has to happen?
Yeah, what is that? What has to happen?
What has to happen is...
Regalachas, you know, like what? How do we fix the...
What has to happen is...
Wait, could I say that? Can I say something?
You could say whatever you want at this point. At this point, you could say whatever you want.
It's your podcast. You do whatever you want. Okay, so...
You can even tell me you're triggering me. Get out of my office.
Yeah. No, I...
Give me some water.
Yeah, we got water here. Here, no, I'm just going to give you the whole thing. So, I think that is it possible that nobody is... Okay, I have this line that I came up with recently. And the line is, before you get married, you're lonely. After you get married, you're also lonely. But you're doing with somebody. That's meaning, well... Meaning's maybe obvious, but the idea is that we don't fix anything by getting married, but we have that connection, like you're talking about, that I get to now do this with someone else. I have a road partner to do this, but it comes with, we have this image, like people always talk, is he ready to get married? And all it is like, is he like so independent in his thinking and feelings, and he's like figured it out that now it's going to be interdependence because they're going to connect two independent people. It never existed in the history of humankind. I don't think so. Is that we are broken as people, and if we could share that with another person, how do you tell that to people that whoever you're marrying is broken? I actually saw a picture recently that someone sent me where I was a teenager and I had like this long flowing hair and I'm like all dirty and like I look like I need some help. And I don't know if I was dirty, but I, you know, and my wife met me then. And in some ways, I think that might be a little bit of the secret of my marriage because
no secrets.
We were talking when I was in the middle of the muck. So I couldn't like go, you know, all of a sudden we're married and be like, no, I'm perfect. What do you mean? Yesterday you were telling me your problems with this. So what I'm saying is that, is it possible, and I don't know if it's what you're saying, but is it possible that a marriage can't work unless we are broken with each other? If you're too good, it's just not going to work. Is that what you're saying? I don't know if I'm hearing you right. You have to be broken with each other for it to bond.
I'm saying that, and I'm saying a little more, I think.
Okay.
I need to breathe and meditate a little bit.
Okay, breathe. That's a good thing about podcasts. You don't have to talk fast. Although, it's mincha soon.
First of all, I would just make a little correction, and that is, when you say we continue to be lonely, but we could be lonely together, we don't heal. I don't want to romanticize brokenness. I believe that essentially trauma is about isolation. And when I'm not lonely, a lot of the trauma gets healed. This doesn't mean I don't still have voices of brokenness inside of me. It does not mean that my loneliness doesn't still come to the surface and wants to hijack my heart. It does not mean that. But it means that with real attachment and connection, a lot of our wounds are healed. Because trauma always happened in isolation. It happened because of isolation, and it creates further isolation. It's back to Lo Yitayv Hayayis Adam Levad. Those words in the Torah, apparently, contain more wisdom than we imagine. Because cutting-edge wisdom of psychology and healing and neuroscience is about not being Levad.
Yeah.
The antithesis of addiction is not sobriety. It's attachment.
It's very interesting because if you go back to the history of psychology, they were trying to do it alone.
Right.
Like the psychoanalysts were like, it's all you. You got this.
So you got this.
And everybody is letting that drop away.
I once went to a very big years ago. I was studying the yeshiva board. I went to a big healer. He was psychologist. And at the end of the conversation, it was intense. And I was walking in. I just wanted to make some friendly talk. And I said, you know, how many children do you have? Where's your wife from? And he looked at me and he said, Dr. Freud has taught that we don't allow such conversations. It must remain completely impersonal. It didn't feel, it was awkward, you know, and that was it. He didn't even say goodbye. But it was a philosophy. The philosophy was put up a wall and maintain that wall. And it's for the benefit of your clients, for the benefit of your patient. Today we're realizing it's in the empathy and attachment where so much of the healing happens.
Right. The therapeutic relationship.
Yeah, the therapeutic relationship. That's, I think, number one. Number two, what I'm saying is when you say, you know, it's in brokenness that we connect, I think, again, I don't like romanticizing brokenness so much. It's through wholeness that we connect, but we only reach our wholeness when we're ready to confront every centimeter of our brokenness. We're not broken people. We're whole people. Mm. That's the good news. We're not broken people. I know in the healing modalities, we talk so much about authenticity with our brokenness that we sometimes feel we're broken people because there's brokenness in us. But it's not the case. We're whole people. And the greatest proof I see is in victims of sexual abuse. When they were 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 or whatever, they were emotionally murdered. If we were machines, if you take a hammer and you continue to bang on that machine for years on end in torturous and abusive ways, that machine should be broken by now. What we're seeing here is that there is a core self that has not been broken, that remembers everything, that knows everything, that knows how wrong it was, that knows how special the child was, even though that core self has been dormant and latent and buried for decades. And suddenly it emerges through healing, hopefully with God's grace. And suddenly we say, hey, where did that come from? I'm whole. I'm not broken. The greatest abuse is not just abuse. It's the belief that I'm really broken. It's the belief that I'm really worthless. It's the belief that I'm really ugly. That's where the real abuse is. But the soul doesn't believe that.
Right.
And when the soul emerges, that wholeness comes out. And that's where all love comes from. Because over there, there's confidence. There is joy. There's curiosity. There's compassion. There's love. There's caring. There's courage. And there is celebration. And there's humility. And there's vulnerability. Because that's what truth looks like.
Right.
But I will never get to even touch my wholeness if I'm not ready to touch all of my broken pieces. Because my wholeness is always right behind my brokenness. And whenever I'm touching something that's broken, and it's very painful, the more painful it is to touch, it's only because the light that's right behind it is more intense. The intensity of darkness is always, always commensurate with the depth of light that it's eclipsing. Why that is, it's one of the mysteries of creation, but it's the truth.
Wow.
So when I'm touching something very, very dark and I am scared to my guts, I am scared and overwhelmed to go there, it's only because that's that wound. That fear is eclipsing my most powerful light. And if I get to that space, if I puncture it, right, the light is going to come in. That's what it's about. When a couple is not afraid of touching that space because they know the other person will not run.
Right.
They will touch their wholeness. And that's where a real connection is. And then the brokenness and the wholeness coexist in a beautiful relationship because we're not afraid of it.
Wow.
And I think what that looks like practically, really looks like practically is, I said this the other day in a class, you know, you're sitting with your wife or you're sitting with your husband, it depends who's listening to this or watching this, and your wife says something to you, and it triggers you. It makes you feel like she doesn't respect you, she doesn't like you, you're a failure, you're a loser.
Right.
And my coping mechanism is run away. Just run away, you know. Either attack or judge or get angry or disassociate, whatever our coping mechanism, you know, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, whatever it is. My coping mechanism may even be saintly, be the tzaddik hadar. Don't feel pain. It's a cleansing of my sins, right? But of course, my anger is burning. It's burning. Whatever. What if I can turn to my wife right then or a little later and say, wow, all my trauma wants to do now is just run away from you for 10 years or forever. I am angry. I am furious. I'm in a very, very miserable space now because of what you said. Wow. You just went back to that klipa, to that shell. You went back to the formation of the coping mechanism and you punctured it.
Right.
Because you're addressing that wound. Now here is the catch. Your wife just got triggered. She was trying to tell you something nice and kind and authentic. Maybe she was even complimenting you. So what happens now? Now imagine she could say, and my trauma has just been seriously triggered by you. And you know what? I feel like you are such an immature baby. Grow up, whatever it is.
Right.
And now it's his turn to run away. So what's happening is they can talk about each other's emotions and attribute it to their trauma. And say, my trauma is being triggered by your trauma. And then they could say, what about our souls? Are our souls being triggered? And they could look at each other and say, our souls are actually celebrating this conversation. Our souls are not afraid of being vulnerable. Our souls are not afraid of failure. Our souls are not afraid of improvement. Our souls are not afraid of saying the truth. Our souls don't have to control. Our souls are confident. We're good. Our souls are pieces of God. We're fine. I'm fine. You could tell me, my tie is dirty. You could tell me my clothes don't match. You could tell me my speech was a miserable failure last night. You could tell me I'm fine. My soul is fine.
Right. It's amazing what you're saying because when a guy comes to this house, like the sober living, and a guy actually asked me today, like, how do you deal with all these broken, you know, like similar to what I was saying? And I said the trick of the village, any village, but this is called our village. The trick is that everybody is all right already when they arrive. It's not that we are making people all right. It's just that they don't know it. We see it. They don't know it. And when they get to know it, I'm just going on a very quick cycle. There's a lot more to this. But when they know it, they're all right. There's a lot of programs that are very focused on all the rules and this and that and how to get them to move and do the job. And we're like, all we have to do is build a container around them where they feel the love and they know they can't fall out. Because someone said, why don't you call it a foundation? I said, if there's an earthquake, the thing falls down out of a foundation. A container, earthquakes, fires, you're still in the container. It might be terrible, but you're in there. The way we see it is exactly what you're saying, is that it's, I don't know even if it's spiritual or not spiritual, but when I look at that couple, I see thunder and lightning. I see the answer. They don't see it if they just saw it. So I'm saying, you're saying with the klipas, you just poke the holes till you see it.
But we have to create safety in those places because when my trauma is being triggered, my deepest wounds are being triggered now. If you are not going to tell me why you're safe, you're safe here. I will not be able to handle this. I'm going to recreate those very same coping mechanisms that got me into this mess. And this time I'm going to create them in a more powerful way so they can withstand my marriage too. They're going to become more powerful than ever before because now I'm a mature man and I'm going to use my intelligence and my prowess to create them. I'm not a 4-year-old. Now I'm going to do it even better. And now I'm really done. Now I'm a dead man walking till my last breath. This is where we have to create safety for each other. And it's hard because we will be triggering and we will trigger each other. And the more successful we are, we're going to get to the deeper places. And when we get to the deeper places, You'll forgive me, but hell will break loose. And when you puncture that spot that's hiding everything, it's going to be very, very intense. And will you be able to contain that?
Right.
Or not? Maybe you won't be able to. And if you don't, because you're also a person, you also have your issues, will I be able to contain the fact that you didn't contain me because of your trauma? Or will I now run away? Right. This will constantly happen. And we both have to have the courage. I mean, both. The husband and I have to have the courage to stay in. And even if I failed, to be able to come back a day later and say, it was very hard for me what happened. And I apologize. But yeah, it was very scary. It was very scary. For me, you were a lion who just came into the room and is about to eat me alive. That's what happened.
Right.
What it's you interesting. Said,
you don't in marriage. You don't hear a lot of the word safety. You don't. People talk about a great marriage.
I think it's all.
It's all safety.
I think.
That's amazing.
I think safety is the portal. It's the portal. Without safety, we are not going to the broken place.
Right. Okay.
I can't afford it. I'm sorry. I can't afford it. I've been alone for 50 years. I'm going to be alone for another 50 years. You know why? I survived. The proof is in the pudding. So right. I'll have a miserable marriage. But I survived.
And you'll survive the miserable marriage.
I'll survive the miserable marriage too. And I'll even be an honored man in my community. And I'll even do the right thing in many ways. And I might give a lot of charity and teach a lot of Torah. And I'm going to daven with a lot of kavanah. And I will ask God every Yom Kippur, please, please take away my misery. And I may become so dysfunctional that I will start calling misery happiness, because it's the month of Adar, and in the month of Adar you have to be happy, and Purim is coming, you have to be happy. So I will use my philosophical brilliance to redefine my misery as happiness. Do you understand that? Do you know what that looks like?
Yes.
But my anger I will not get rid of. And it will come out passive, in a passive-aggressive way. It will come out. Because I'm a saint, so nobody sees my anger, because I'm a very, very good man. But I'm an angry, angry, broken man. And it's going to come out. It's going to come out in very interesting ways. And without real awareness, without the gift of awareness, we go nowhere. We watch people who are 70 years old, and they're exactly the same. Nothing has changed. They're literally in the same mode. Nothing has changed, and it's astounding. And we're talking about good people.
Right.
People who are kind and generous and want to do the right thing. It's mamish, not their fault. There's absolutely not an iota of judgment here. I would have been exactly in the same place.
Right.
Have I not had the gift of God's grace and support, I would have been exactly in the same place.
Right.
And sometimes you speak to the most intelligent, brilliant people, and they just, they're clueless in this area, because trauma is deeper than intelligence. Trauma happened when they were two, when they were three. Their intelligence developed later. So nothing of their intelligence has touched that spot. And I'll say something else. Some of us have been in therapy for 30 years. It hasn't gotten us there. Because talk therapy is amazing, but it has a lot of limits.
Yeah.
Talk therapy can't take me to pre-verbal spaces. I don't have what to say. There's no words. It didn't come in through words. It's not going to go out through words. So I think there's also another major component here. And that is, this work is not done every day. It's done every minute.
Now you're making it feel overwhelming.
in a beautiful way, it's done every minute. Every minute of the day, I have to ask myself, do I want to live in alignment? Or do I want to live in dissonance? It's a minute by minute choice.
Okay,
literally,
we're gonna have to finish in a second. But I have like a bunch of other questions. I wonder if
Want to say one more thing about this.
Yes,
I think it's critical. One of the biggest mistakes we make in marriages is we think we go into a default mode of a good relationship and it lasts. It's ludicrous. We go on a vacation. It's been amazing. We got away from the kids. For a full week, the most beautiful island in the world, okay? We had an amazing time. We come home, we're expecting now a journey to paradise for the next 60 years. Already the next day, there was an argument, and at the end of it, we both lift up our hands in despair. And he's thinking, here she goes again. Oh my God. And she's like, wow, he's just impossible. He's just like his mother. He'll never change. You know that line? They both sigh, and they walk in opposite directions, and they just drifted away emotionally.
Right.
What just happened? What happened was their expectations were completely not based on reality. To build this type of relationship, you are combating one of the most powerful forces in the world. It's the force of loneliness that gets its power from the lack of trust and safety. How much trust and safety is there in this world? We live in a cruel world. So my default mode is no trust, no safety, especially if I didn't grow up with much of it. So my default mode is I can't trust my spouse. The fact that I trusted you yesterday doesn't mean I could trust you today. My trauma doesn't live with progress. It lives frozen in time. I trusted you yesterday. My soul trusted you. My trauma still doesn't trust. So if we don't constantly choose to connect and reconnect and deal with every new trigger that came up, we will fall back. And a lot of people don't like this. It's too vulnerable.
Yeah.
I don't have triggers. Come on. I'm already a tzaddik. Am I not a tzaddik? Come on. How long do you want to work on yourself? But the truth is, this is the only way forward. Everything else is miserable. David HaMelech said, V'chatasi negdi samet. My sin is always in front of my eyes. The Tanya says that's not a depressing thought. It's a liberating thought. It's an emancipating thought. You know why? It means that you know that to connect to your soul, you have to be ready at a moment's notice to deal with every broken feeling that sets into your psyche. And when a couple can be there for each other on that level, it's incredible. And the results are magical.
They are magical. I definitely agree with that. They are magical, and I want everybody to experience them. It's interesting what you were saying.
I do have to say it's not going to work if people are not ready. If one of the parties is ready to confront, the other party is not ready to confront, maybe because of personality disorder, mental illness, serious trauma, not their fault.
Right, right.
But if I'm not ready to confront.
But I think majority of the time is a mirror. Like when one person starts, the other one starts. That's what I see.
Often, but sometimes not.
Sometimes not.
You have someone who is so stuck.
And that's why we have divorce.
That's why we have divorce. And sometimes you have one person who's a really.
Which is the next topic I wanted to ask
you
about.
Very important.
A quick topic. Not so quick. Okay, I had. I did have one more point, but I'm going to skip it because I want to ask you this question because I've been confused about this. There's a couple of things that's happened to me recently that kind of opened my eyes to a reality that I never really occurred to me. One of them is October 7th where I knew the world, there was issues, like people didn't like us, but it didn't occur to me like where we were at. And I know that's naive and it's also probably yeah, helps us survive.
Like most Jews of our generation.
Right.
You're like most Jews of our generation.
Right.
Divorced from the heartbeat of Jewish history.
No, I am not divorced. I study it all. And even with studying it all, it was still shocking.
Yeah.
And it was, I guess it was shocking how fast and furious it was.
Yeah.
That's really what got me.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, okay, then the other topic, this is interesting. I had on, and I've heard you say, this is interesting, I've heard you say in the past, like about the idea of suppressing somebody's thoughts, like free press. And you talked about your father being a newspaper man and like, you know, not suppressing thoughts, even if you disagree with them and all that stuff. I had on the Flatbush girl, which is a real controversial issue. Interestingly, similar to I don't want to compare it to the anti-Semitism, but I was aware that it's a controversial issue, but didn't really understand it. And I really wanted to hear her side. And the amount of, and this is, I'm getting to the question, but the amount of vitriol and anger that I got from, you know, her stance on how she's doing things and she's fighting for this Aguna crisis, which I thought is a lovely idea. Fighting for the Agunas, to me, as the naive person who fights for the people who are suffering, thought it was a lovely idea. And obviously she's triggering different things and coming up with different ideas to make, you know, to make it more public and all that. But even before the idea is to make it more public, the amount of people that came over to me and we were like shutting it down. There were a couple of questions there, and I was like, I really want to talk to you about it. And we spent the whole podcast talking about other things, but I really want to talk to you about it. One of them was, is there still a massive hatred of women from men? Like, I didn't, that was my first, like, I, that, cause it was like, it felt like just because it's a woman doing this work, it felt like men were furious. Like, she's getting up and saying something. I don't think it was about how she was saying it so much. I think it was that a woman getting up and saying that this has to be done, like bossing around the men, triggered everybody. Wow. To the point. It's just something I wanted to bring up with you because it was just an observation. I've had serious arguments with people. It's not really an argument. I'm just listening to them because I don't even know where my stance is. My stance is she's fighting for Arguna. She has some wacky ideas how to do it. They don't really bother me so much. Like, it's not like, I don't know, like ruin marriages and stuff. Like, everybody comes up with something. But even before the crazy ideas, there was such a – so, like, in the case of anti-Semitism, it's like I kind of know that non-Jews struggle with their relationship with us. I know that from history. And I don't know
they struggle. They would struggle, it would be fine.
I'm saying it nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, a good struggle would be good.
If they would struggle and yeah. say, hey, what is hey, that? What is the issue with a Jew? That's where healing happens.
Maybe it's not Zionists that I hate.
Right, it's so interesting. The moment we confront demons, that's the moment we begin the process of redemption. Why? Wow, that's a demon. What is it? It's about me. That's an incredibly blessed process.
Right.
The moment the anti-Semites start doing that, we know that a lot of good things are going to happen.
Well, that would be nice.
It's really people confront them. That's, by the way, one of the great colossal errors of Jews, blaming anti-Semitism on themselves. They don't realize that this is a demon that the anti-Semite has to wrestle with.
Right.
I got to wrestle my demon. You got to wrestle yours. If I start taking responsibility for your demon.
Well, like you said before, if you don't even see it, how do you wrestle with it? That's the biggest issue I've seen.
One of the greatest mistakes Jews have is they don't understand the boundaries between their responsibility and the anti-Semitic experience.
Right.
And they're so enmeshed and entangled. If I'll only change my nose and change my forehead, if I'll cease to be such an apartheid occupier, cruel, dirty, filthy, communist Jew, everybody will love me.
Right.
Even Hitler is being triggered by us. Bin Laden, we trigger them. We trigger them. And that's when Jews start, ducking in fear and bending their posture out of shape and not knowing who they are anymore, trying to worthlessly appease. People are just not ready to confront their demons. So, yeah.
Right. But okay, so, question. But no, my question was about this.
Do men hate women?
There were two things. It was men hate women, and how are we supposed to look at this Aguna crisis? Like, it is a question of mine because, I wasn't absolutely fascinated by it. But then I got fascinated by, like, what exactly is supposed to be our view on this situation?
So the truth is that, I have to just make a disclaimer. I'm not a rabbinic halachic authority, certainly not in the realm of, not in no realm, but also not in the realm of divorce and gittin. So what I'm saying here is more of, a brother to brothers and a brother to sisters from just living in my community and talking to people and hearing people. I believe what's happened in our communities is really a shanda, it's a disgrace. Because every man who's refusing to give a get is getting some support. Even if the fact that he can walk into shul and he's not expelled from shul, he's getting a certain respect, right? There's family protecting him. There's friends protecting him. There may be rabbis who are protecting him. And the same is true the other way around. If there's a woman who's torturing her husband and not ready to accept a get. And the fact that we as a community have not treated this with the ultimate seriousness and have allowed so many women to suffer for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, remain in shackles, literally in shackles. She cannot move on to she cannot move on with her life because of this despicable, unforgivable, unfathomable behavior of an abusive husband, or conversely, of an abusive wife, is a disgrace on us. The first foremost function of Torah is to be able to create safety for the vulnerable, to be able to help the brokenhearted, to be able to protect the orphans, to protect the widows, to be able to protect those who are foreigners. How many times the Rambam says the Torah warns us 36 times to be sensitive and respectful to the ger, to the convert, who comes from a different culture and doesn't have, you know, the protectia, the nepotism, the family and community power. So Agunas, who do they have? They have nobody.
Right.
And instead of standing up for them, very often there are people who support the other person, even with only a smile. Unfortunately, it's the first time in my life, I hope it's the last time in my life, that I had to throw somebody out of shul.
Really?
Yeah. In my shul, I have a woman who hasn't had her get in almost 20 years. She comes every Shabbos to us. She comes to many of my classes. And there was a man there who would walk 6 miles on Shabbos to come to my classes. So it was flattering for me. Guy walked 6 miles Shabbos morning to come to my class in Likud Torah from the Alter Rebbe. 6 miles? I don't walk 6 miles. I walk 6 minutes. And his marriage was in a crisis. His wife wanted a divorce. And I thought, you know, with my gift of gab, I'll be able to be persuasive. And with my psychological techniques, I'll be able to achieve the impossible. And for a few years, I tried and tried and tried and tried to no avail. Until I told him, you can't come to shul anymore. Until you give a get, I don't want you in any of my classes. I don't want you in the shul where I daven. I cannot daven to Hashem in good conscience, knowing that there's somebody here who's abusing his wife and his 8 children. None of them speak to him because of the get.
Right.
And I believe if every single Jew would do this, we would eliminate all support. And every woman who's an aguna would have a support system. As I told them, every aguna needs a support system. She needs a few rabbis. She needs lawyers. She needs people with money, with business. Every woman needs a team.
Wow.
Needs a team around her. She deserves a team. Woman can't do this alone. Especially a woman, she has 6 kids. She has 4 kids trying to pay tuition because the guy doesn't even send a penny. It's not fair. So this woman needs a team around her, a top-level team, a coach, a lawyer, a businessman, a rabbi, family, a team. And the team strategizes. And the fact that they don't have this, and the fact that in one way or another we give even tiny support to everyone who refuses to give a get, is a disgrace to our community. The fact that the rabbinic leadership and all of the Jewish people are not single-mindedly focused with an unwavering tenaciousness and commitment to protect these women is an eternal disgrace on us as a community.
Wow. That's very well said. Okay.
I think it's the truth.
I feel very, very strongly the same way. And I've been...
The same thing happened with child sexual abuse for decades.
Right.
People may have good intentions. This is not a personal judgment on people. A rabbi is busy. He's trying to run a shul. He wants to be nice. I'm not a guy who throws people out of shuls.
Right.
I never threw anyone out of shul.
I can't imagine you throwing someone
out. That type of guy. And I didn't like it. But I felt I'm now going to be the hypocrite just because he's walking 6 miles to my classes. I'm going to be the hypocrite and he could sit here. And by the way, he's a brilliant guy, Yale graduate, asked excellent questions. The crowd loved him in the class. You know, I like interactive classes. I'm going to now be a hypocrite because it's working for my ego. I'm not going to do that. I said, leave shul.
Wow.
Leave. Don't come back here. Do not come back. Do not step foot into my shul.
And no one should let him into any shul.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know what shul. Why is anyone letting him into any shul?
Yeah.
Such a person should not be allowed to join a minyan. You don't talk to God while you're abusing your wife. There's Haftarah of Yom Kippur from the prophet Yeshaya, Isaiah. And he speaks over there. God says, you think your fasting is going to appease me? You think your fasting is what I need? He says, what do I need? I need you to remove the shackles of people whose lives have been broken, of the devastated, of the wretched, of the orphans, of the widows, of people suffering. Stop abusing people. Stop violating people. That's what I call a day of atonement. That's what we read in the Haftarah of Yom Kippur. Everybody could read it. It's from my Yeshaya Hanavi, who was also a religious Jew.
Right.
When we lose sight of that, and we know how to make signs and call kairis and protests about everything against halacha, besides child sexual abuse, it took decades for people to talk about. And again, they didn't know. I'm not judging anybody. Principals, rabbis, we'll deal with it. We'll deal with it. We'll send them to Israel. So he goes to Israel and he abuses another 40 kids. We'll send them away from Australia. So he goes to England and abuses another 100 kids. You know, take the Chaim Wilder case, right? 25 years. This is one of the most celebrated psychologist in Israel, one of the greatest authors of children's books in the Orthodox world.
Crazy.
It's a crazy story. You think people didn't know about it? 25 years ago, they didn't know. They knew about it.
Right.
But they fought, you know, whatever. So what happened? Thank God, today, it's not fixed yet. But there's more consciousness. There's more awareness. A school realizes if there's a predator caught, you know, you got to deal with it. You got to deal with it. If somebody has a gun and goes to a school every Friday and shoots a kid, nobody asks you allowed to go to the police.
Right.
Suddenly here, when you're killing a kid for life, I don't have to tell you.
Yeah.
I don't have to tell you the results of child sexual abuse.
No.
You're murdering a person for years. He's a dead man or she's a dead woman. Hopefully they'll get the healing they need because their souls are never dead, as we said earlier. Right. And suddenly here, it's like, nah, it took years for people to come around. Years and testimony and how much pain. And even today, there's people who are still a little queasy about it.
Yeah, but I want to tell you, I saw videos of some of these protests were going on, and there was another side, meaning they were protesting against a get refuser. And then there was another side. What is the side? And I don't know what it was. It was a whole side of people going, you shouldn't be here. What are you talking about? Yeah.
And then they use halacha and Torah and mitzvahs. The Rambam says, the Rambam was also an Orthodox Jew. And the Rambam writes, the whole Torah was given to make peace and harmony. The Rambam says there that Hashem wants his name to be erased to make peace between a husband and a wife. The whole function of Torah was to bring peace to people, harmony, a sense of joy, tranquility, safety, security, oneness, attachment, simcha. So in the name of Allah, in the name of Torah, we can abuse. It's like idolatry. It's like a pagan religion. You know, you slaughter kids on the altar to appease some god who doesn't exist. That's what I often feel. We like lose touch with the essence. If justice, compassion, kindness, generosity, safety of the vulnerable and of the children, of the women, of the men, is not our highest priority, which god are we serving? Take your god and you could burn him because he never existed.
Wow.
Take your god on paper, tear it up and throw it in the garbage. It's not a god any normal person wants to worship. It's a corrupt god. It's called a pagan god.
Right.
The fact that you call him a Jewish god just means that you have adopted your pagan god and call him a Jewish god. I'm not going to buy it. I'm not going to be part of this.
Right.
It's below our dignity. It's a betrayal of our history. I told somebody 4,000 years Jews have sacrificed everything to hold on to their Yiddishkeit. For what? So that we could protect sexual predators and abusers? Tell me for what? Tell me for what? For what? What did we hold on to exactly? What's the sacred treasure that we fought the whole world? We were slaughtered in the millions to hold on to. For what? So I could protect abusers in my community? That's the crescendo of Jewish history? Tell me. That a guy who's torturing his wife for 15 years can get away with it? Because he goes to the mikveh every day and puts on Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin and only eats badatz hechsher? Because he's a frum guy? That's the crescendo of our religion?
I think it's
this
sick.
Are my ancestors, we all had to sacrifice so much? Tell me. It's the basics. The basics is the fight for justice, for truth, for the safety of people, for people not to be tortured. Thinking about Chas V'Shalom, you know, think about your own daughter.
Right.
Right? Think about your own daughter. People think about your own daughter, your sister, your daughter, yourself. Being in chains for 10, 15 years and at the mercy of a person using halacha in a sinister way. Is there a greater desecration of God and halacha than this? And the fact that all leaders are not outspoken about this in the most forceful of ways, I think is a disgrace.
Well, you're giving me a lot of comfort with your words because I feel like yelling as much as you just yelled. And I really, really believe
I'm
this
I'm not
is...
even articulating 10% of what has to be articulated about this. Think if it was your son, if it was your daughter.
Yeah, it's...
Think about it. Think about your daughter being an aguna. And sometimes it's the other way. Sometimes the wife torturing, you know, so you have women who have their illness and their mishagasin, they're torturing their husbands. That's also a tzar. I don't mean to sound here, you know, it's always the man is the rush and the woman is a tzaddik. It's not always that way.
Right.
Some women are very sick people too. Some women are very, very sick people.
Well,
there was a divorced couple, and I could cry when I tell this story, and they were making a bar mitzvah for the boy and the son. The father is from Flatbush, made a beautiful bar mitzvah. He felt this is a way of, you know, giving his child the dignity that he didn't have because, you know, his parents weren't married. It's hard for him. And what did the mother do? The ultimate revenge of her ex. She didn't let her son come to the bar mitzvah. So you have a bar mitzvah in Flatbush, 300 people. Everybody came to the bar mitzvah because they knew that it was a sensitive situation and it was a difficult divorce. She didn't allow her son to come to the bar mitzvah. So the father has a bar mitzvah. He has a bunch of guests and the boy is not there. You understand?
Wow.
This kid is going to get older one day. What is he going to think about his mother? She's a sick woman. She's a sick woman.
It's really sick.
She probably has such crazy, intense trauma to the point that she is so disassociated from her emotions, so disconnected. But there's a cruelty here. You know, there's a cruelty.
Yeah. Well, it's really, it's unbelievable.
This kid is going to grow up and you know... Like, what her hatred to her husband, you know, they ask Golda Meir, right? When is there going to be peace? And she said, when the Arabs start loving their children more than they hate ours, there'll be peace. Right? When Hamas starts loving the people in Gaza more than they hate Jewish children, there'll be peace in a day. Right. You know, you may be divorced or you may be separated and you may hate your spouse or ex-spouse and maybe for good reason. Maybe for very good reason. I'm not here to say, but the moment you hate them more than you love your children, the moment you hate them more than you love yourself, you have just become a horrible, horrible victim of your hate. Right. The moment I'm shooting myself because I hate you, it means that the hate has consumed my entire life. There's no me left. Love yourself. You hate this guy, okay, but love yourself. Respect yourself. Love your children. Don't use your children as missiles, as little missiles. This is what our enemies do. They use their people right. as missiles just to destroy Israel. And we don't want to do that.
We're doing awesome. Okay. I think we're going to stop.
Okay.
I really, really appreciate you coming. Thank you so much.
Thank you for this day that I've been given. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this chance. Thank you for this chance to live anew.
This class is brought to you by the yeshiva.net. Please help us continue the classes. Make even a small contribution at www.theyeshiva.net/donate.